I had a show that lasted 11 years.
I didn't know that.
Starting
and ending. I mean, when did
I don't know. I really don't know. It ended when I left Hollywood for Europe and began.
Oh, in the late
40s. In the 36. It ended in the late 40s.
I didn't know that.
That's the radio. That's the biggest thing in my life. Every week, an hour show.
How did The Shadow originate? Was it a show before you took over?
No, I was the original Lamont Kratz, as far as I know, but yeah. I wouldn't
but
want
But you
to...
didn't write that.
Oh, no, my God, I didn't even know how they came out. I didn't rehearse them, you know. I didn't have dress rehearsals. I didn't know how I'd get out of the well ever when I was thrown in.
Yeah. And you never had anything to do with that marvelous... opening speech.
Well, I
who
said
knows
it. I
you,
said
you
that
said.
That day. Yeah, you know, evil lurks in the hearts of men.
And the laugh was your laugh.
Yes, but it was. I had a
reverb.
No, I don't. Oh, my goodness, I just did it. But and all the children in the world did it. You know, in those days,
well,
every
I did
kid.
It.
Yeah.
But I don't think I heard you originally. You were.
I was it. You just don't know. I was Lamont Kratz.
In the 40s too.
Well, they kept replaying them. They were records, you see.
Yeah,
I'm sure I was.
Well, that was my favorite radio show.
Yeah. People keep talking about it. I hear on television, people keep talking, making jokes about Lamont Cranston. They still remember that name.
They remember it.
Yeah.
The Shadow.
And they don't know I was it. I keep wanting to say, that was me.
Were there other Lamont Cranstons?
Yes. Martin Gable followed me. And then I don't know how many others. Through the years,
the Mercury Theater on the air, was that the which started in 38, I guess. Was that the first place you developed what was known, I suppose, as the first person singular, the idea of telling the stories in the first
person? I developed it in a show that I did for ABC, what was then ABC Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Which was my first job as a writer director for radio, which was to do Les Miserables on a series of 13 weeks. And I developed the narration, first-person narration thing for that.
Mm-hmm. And then you were going to carry it into all the way through into Heart of Darkness.
Well, that was years later, yeah.
Yeah. But you've actually never used it in a movie.
I guess not. I've used it in enough scripts that I haven't made.
Actually, the War of the Worlds broadcast was your first piece of really bad luck, wasn't it?
No, good luck.
In retrospect, though, I mean.
Great good luck.
Was it?
Never would have gone to movies without it.
Oh, really?
Never would have got a commercial account without it. We were a sustaining show.
Yeah. No sponsor.
We got a sponsor the next week. So it was great good luck.
It was a direct result of that.
Direct result. The sponsor had turned us down 2 weeks before because we attended to too much violence and sensationalism. Picked us up the week after the War of the Worlds.
Was that Campbell's?
Campbell's soup. As sure as you like chicken, you like Campbell's chicken soup.
You did the commercials, too.
No. Announcer called Chapel did, and we worked on him for years. And every time he said that in rehearsal, we'd say, because we'd read in some paper that Campbell's was looking for roosters, old roosters, for their soup. And as soon as he'd say it in rehearsal, we'd say, as soon as you like chicken, we'd all say, you like Campbell's rooster soup. And he finally said it on the air. You know? Yes, he said it on the air. Made everybody so happy. Terrible trouble, you know, off to Philadelphia to see the man. Jack Houseman fell all over his face explaining it. You should have seen it.
Oh, God.
One time at the end of a radio production, while introducing next week's show and star, Joseph Cotten is supposed to have said, "And next week, that great star of stage and radio, Sonny Tufts."
Is that a true story about Joseph Cotten saying, "And next week, Sonny Tufts"?
Well, I say I said it. That's the great disagreement between us.
Well, tell me the story.
Well, each one of us claims that we did it, and we both have clear recollection of it. It's one of those mysteries.
Was it on the Mercury show?
No, years later on a show called Suspense, directed by William Spears. And I claim that I'm the one who said it first. Each one of us said it. The argument is who said it first.
Wasn't the War of the Worlds the first encounter you had with censorship afterward, at least?
We had no encounter with censorship, really.
Well, they told you couldn't do... Didn't they say you couldn't do that kind of news broadcast business anymore?
No, they just told the world they couldn't. They passed laws.
Oh, the FCC?
Yes, FCC passed laws, but we had a sort of censorship all through the day on our... Because I only rehearsed one day for the shows. And all through the day, we had the CBS censor saying, you can't say Grover's Mills, you must say Grover's Corners. Little things like that, not knowing that they were preparing this time bomb. Mm. So we'd made all these little changes very cooperatively and blew the lid over off CBS so they couldn't complain. We did everything they asked.
Well, did you know it would have that kind of effect?
Only the size was a surprise. My idea was to send a lot of the lunatic fringe out. I just didn't know how widespread the fringe was.
You mean how little...
Yeah.
How it wasn't a fringe?
Yeah, because I got the idea from a BBC show that had gone on the year before when a Catholic priest told how some communists had seized London. And a lot of people in London believed it. And I thought that'd be fun to do on a big scale. Let's have it from the outer space. That was how I got the idea.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But you claimed afterward to be very innocent about it.
Of course I did. They were suing me for $20 million, you know. Of course I claimed. Mm. The only thing is that they didn't have records of it at the time, and I came out at the end and said, this was Halloween Eve, and this was our little way of soaping your window and saying boo. In other words, admitting malice.
Mm.
But luckily, they didn't catch that.
But there is a record of it out.
A pirated record, which people have made fortunes of money and have no right to play.
Hmm. But was it a record of the original broadcast?
Taken off the air.
Oh, I see.
You see,
somebody
pirated it. Yes, yeah, right. And it's been sold over and over again. It's been broadcast, everything. I've never made a cent off it.
Oh.
And I've tried to stop them because it's a bad record. And
it's
does
not a
the,
good
no,
record,
it's,
no.
No, the show is no
And
good.
It doesn't seem to be complete either.
I don't even know that. I've only heard the first 4 or 5 minutes, and I turned it off. It was so poor.
But you said to me the other day that it was actually one of your worst shows.
Not worst shows, at least. No, I don't think that's true. I shouldn't have given that impression. It was, I don't know how I gave that impression. It just wasn't...
Well, maybe you were impatient with talking about it. I don't know.
No, I didn't mean one of the worst, but just, you know, by no means one of our best. It had good things. The technical use of silence, I think, was very effective when we said in the middle of it, you know, is there anybody on the air?
That was great.
Is there anybody on the air? Big pause. Is there any...
Yeah,
and just left it, you know. That was all right.
Yeah, and I like the cutting back between Ramon Roqueiro's.
Yeah, all that was invented during rehearsal. Yeah. And I think the man who gets the biggest credit for that show is Paul Stewart.
He was the narrator?
No, he was the assistant. He was my director, acting director. And he did an awful lot of that work before I even got into it.
Because you only came for one day. Huh?
Yes, and all the technical side was worked out before, and then I revised it.
Mm-hmm.
To everybody's irritation dramatically and all that, and put their backs up every week. That was...
Because you would...
Yeah, that's no good. Let's do it another way, you know, all that.
Yeah.
But he did that awfully well.
But that's the way you used to do all the shows. They'd get it ready, and then you'd come in and...
They did a recording of the show not the real cast, with a... skeleton cast of cheap actors and the sound effects in the script. And I would sometimes listen to it and always read their script, and I had 4 days until airtime to rewrite it or get another writer, everything, and go again. That was the way it went.
But the actual recording was done...
There was never a record. It was
live.
Yeah.
But the preparation took one day.
That's right.
With the all the actors.
Short day, yeah. About 5 or 6 hours.
Well, I always thought that it was something, the reverberations of the War of the Worlds broadcast, the fact that a lot of people disliked you for what you had made fools of them.
I don't think anybody did.
Really?
No.
Wasn't there a hue and cry?
Or
were they sheepish about it?
Most of the hue and cry was made by the newspapers because it was a big chance to attack radio, which was taking the advertising away from them.
Oh.
Most people just thought it was funny. There were questions for a lot of people who called up in tears and a few suicides and all that. But basically, people thought it was funny.
Mm.
No, I didn't suffer at all. The people who imitated it, one did in Chile, and somebody did in France, and somebody did in, I don't know, Ecuador, some other remote place. They all got put in jail afterwards. And all I did was get picked up by Campbell's Soup.
Orson's own version of Bram Stoker's Dracula was actually the very first broadcast of the Mercury Theater on the air.
You know what would make a marvelous movie?
What?
Now, you're going to laugh at this. Dracula. Nobody's ever made it.
Nobody's ever really made it well. You're
right. I don't mean well.
Oh, you mean...
They've never paid any attention to the book. I did it on the radio. I did it on the radio. It's the most hair-raising, marvelous book in the world.
I didn't know.
Oh, God, it's wonderful. They've never used anything from it. They haven't even opened the book. Oh, my God, when he comes to... when he comes in from, in one scene, London, with a bag, a heavy bag, and throws it into the corner of the cellar, and it's full of screaming babies, you know.
Oh, my God.
You know, it's they can go far now. This is really Polanski. You know, one of those morbid boys is just made for him. You'd have to call it something else now.
Sure.
But it's, God, what, of course, it's told by four different, it's got the greatest chase in it in the world. They never even have a chase in it, you know. It's all based on the play. Stoker was the stage manager of Henry Irving, and Dracula was based on Henry Irving. It was his vengeance on Henry Irving. He was a very considerable writer, Bram Stoker.
Yeah,
old drunken Irishman. Extraordinary. Now he wrote some very good books. And he offered Dracula to Irving to make a play of it. It would have made marvelous for Irving. He didn't do it. But it was obviously Irving. That's who he was describing all the time.
Oh,
but it's a hair-raising book.
You know that Murnau made a film of it.
Yes.
It's kind of interesting.
But not of Dracula.
Well, it's supposed to be. But
no, it's a vampire story.
There is a chase in it, though.
Yeah, but it's nothing to do with it. And it's told by four people.
Oh,
it must be done with a four narratives, like the radio thing. Because it's four.
Well, you did it that way.
Oh, yes.
Gee, I'd love to hear that.
Oh, God, it was wonderful. Strigoika. Oh, it's just marvelous. Marvelous. What the movies were all based on was a play, which I played in the theater in Ireland. I played Dracula. Which was written by a publisher called...
Horace Liveright? That was a publisher.
Yes, I know, but it's a name like that who was, you know, decided to write a play and wrote this corny, terrible play in two sets, just awful, which was one of the biggest moneymakers of all time.
Yeah, really?
And it works terribly well in the theater. I adored doing it. Nothing to do with the book. And all the movies have been based on the play.
I see.
Not on the book. Nobody's gone
book.
Back to the book. They did go back for the sea trip, a little bit in the sea when he comes by boat.
Orson now talks about three different productions based on Herman Melville's novel, Moby Dick. The first was a stage version Orson wrote called Moby Dick Rehearsed, which he directed on the London stage in 1955. The second was a New York production of this same play of his that was put on by others several years later. And the third is the film version of Moby Dick, in which Orson played Father Maple, directed by John Huston in the mid-50s.
The thing about Moby Dick, I was so lucky, is that I had an extraordinary cast of actors, you know. They're all stars now, practically everybody.
Who was in it?
Kenneth Williams, Joan Plowright. It's her first role, really. She was extraordinary in it, as Pip. And Patrick McGoohan, who should have been, I think, one of the biggest actors of this generation, if TV hadn't grabbed him. He was Starbuck, and he was tremendous. And the sort of small part dancer actors were very great too, and everybody loved the show and consented to rehearse about 14 hours a day for 4 weeks instead of 8 hours a day. And it's a show that simply couldn't be put on in America, with the equity people watching the clock and abiding by their little book, unless you had 2 months or something, because it's technically for them to learn, you know, to do the storm at sea and make you believe that the whole theater was tossing on the waves and so on. It was very athletic and acrobatic and choreographed and very, very intricately and rehearsed in great detail and great precision, and it took a superb gang of people, team. Yeah. Had a lot of very, very real help from everybody in it, and I just refused to do it in America for a long time because I couldn't imagine duplicating it. And then I was weak and let them in. I knew it couldn't succeed because they didn't have the conditions necessary.
No. Well, they didn't have the director.
Well, I don't know. They just didn't have the conditions. I can't criticize it because I didn't see it. He always thought his father should play, and that's why I think Walter Huston was a great actor, but not an Ahab. I think John's much better for it.
He would have been. He had a bigger size.
Yes. Yeah. And loonier quality, you know. There's something terribly sane about Walter, and there's something loony about John as an actor, you know. Which is great in the right thing.
Had you been a big movie fan before you came out here? Had you always wanted to make films?
Never wanted to make films, but the true kind of movie fan with no interest in it as an art form.
Just went to the movies.
Just loved to go to the movies without taking them very seriously or ever considering myself in it. And I was so uninterested that's how I got that wonderful contract. I just went on saying no because I didn't really want to do it. And I just made impossible conditions so that it wouldn't ever happen.
Really?
Yeah.
You didn't really want to make pictures?
Not all that, but I thought it was something to do. I was happy to do it, but it wasn't no burning desire to. I fell in love with it when I got here and started
to do it.
Yes.
But what really... What?
By the time I'd been here even a few weeks, I was just mad to get started. I found out I liked it very much out here in those days. I thought I liked much more than I do now.
You liked the people or the...
Just the whole town. It was kind of fun, I thought. I was... everybody thinks that I was so badly treated by everybody, and I was vilely attacked in restaurants and everything, but I also made an awful lot of friends, and it was still the movie town, you know, not the airplane manufacturing town or the TV industry or anything, and it was the golden days still. There was a sort of a glitter of the old nonsensical circus Hollywood left that was very amusing.
Which you liked?
Yes, I enjoyed it enormously. And one of the first things I wanted to do was to make a movie about the silent movies.
Really?
Yes, that was one of my first projects when I got out here.
That's funny, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to make a movie about the very early days.
Yeah.
A movie about the silent days of pictures, which Orson and I discuss here, I finally did make, some years later, as Nickelodeon. Orson had some input in that script and was supposed to play a leading role in it, but things unfortunately didn't work out that way.
You still want to do that?
Oh, sure, but if you make it.
I haven't got a deal on it or anything. It's something I want to do, nothing specific. But it's interesting that it was something you wanted to do. You just were interested in...
Because I became fascinated in the old movie people. I got to know all the old-timers the minute I got here, the ones I wanted to meet, and I did.
Like who?
Griffith, and I didn't get to know him so well, but I wanted to, and, you know, the obvious ones that you might think of, like Chaplin and Vidor and Van Dyck and all those kind of people, and who were... either from Silence or the very beginning of Talkies. Mm-hmm. And I listened to all the stories. It was still close enough then to those days, so it was awfully easy to get to the sources of it all.
Yeah.
And it sounded to me like it was a fascinating setup and a wonderful movie to be made about it. You know? Mm-hmm. Would have been easier then than now. Now you really have to create it. It'd be more of a, be yeah. freer, but less true, maybe.
Did you, but you wanted to meet those people just because you...
Yes, not because of the movie. That's why I began to want to...
do it.
To make a movie about it. Because they'd talk about it and talk about their first beginnings and all that. And I became very interested in the early Hollywood, but only when I got here. Never struck me before as being fascinating. And in a way, you know, Kane was part of that because not the very early Hollywood, but the pretty early, this town began to be dominated by Hearst, and it kind of was partly from that road that I came to.
That's fascinating. Did you, what movies did you like as a young, as a boy, or when you were just a movie fan?
I suppose...
do you remember a particular...
Yes. I think the movie I like best from the point of view of an actor was The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Lon Chaney. Mm-hmm. I still think it's one of the greatest things I've ever been done.
Mm-hmm.
It was unbelievable. I saw it last year again.
Just as an acting
performance. Yes, just as a creation of it. I don't know what it is, whether it's acting or whatever it is, but it's absolutely fabulous, I think. Every time he's on the screen. I loved that as a kid, and I loved Douglas Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. I loved Keaton. I was not as keen about Chaplin as I was about Keaton. I saw some Keaton movies this year again.
And he is great.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I became very friendly with him. He was one of the people I got to know very well.
That was in his down...
Laurel and Hardy I got to know very well.
And that was Keaton in his down and out period.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to know him actually a little later, not when I first came here, but during the Stage Door Canteen days. He used to work in the Stage Door Canteen, and that's how I got to know him. We'd go out and eat meals together.
I always thought he was a great director.
Yes.
I mean, a great...
I think The
director.
General is one of the most beautiful movies that's ever been made.
Yeah.
Visually.
Visually, yeah.
Yes.
And he was a much greater director than Chaplin.
Yes. Yes. Not as much of a virtuoso performer as Chaplin, but he was certainly one of the most beautiful men that ever been on the screen. Extraordinary.
Yeah. I've seen his early stuff and it's just great.
But I didn't, there's a whole section of movies, old movies, that I never saw, which are supposed to have influenced me, which are the German Expressionist movies. I've never seen them. I've never seen...
To now, even.
Even to now.
Mm-hmm.
I saw some German Expressionist theater. And Brecht, but I mean the real Expressionist theater, which was... Brecht was a sort of special institution, you know. And was very impressed by it, as I was by the Russians as a child. But I didn't happen to see any of those Pabst and Murnau movies, ever.
In this next discussion, when Orson speaks of O'Flaherty, he means Robert Flaherty, the great director of Nanook of the North and Man of Erin.
The only movies that I saw I didn't have much choice. I went to the movies that my mother or father wanted to go see, and they liked O'Flaherty and low comedy and O'Flaherty and I never heard about German movies or that kind of thing. They either didn't know about them or didn't care about them.
And you went to the Chaplin and...
Yeah.
And the comedies.
And the comedies. Mm-hmm. A lot of those. And I used to like... I was mad about Douglas Fairbanks as of, age six.
Did you get to know Alan?
So was Larry Olivier, he told me.
Oh, really?
Yes, he was absolutely hooked on it. That was his great influence.
Oh, how funny, really.
Yeah.
Did you get to know Alan Dwan at all?
No, never met him.
Well, he was the one who directed Fairbanks.
I know.
I just did an interview with him that lasts 16 hours on tape.
Really?
Yeah, and that's what made me want to do the early days, because he was there since 1909, you know. He's been in it since the same time Griffith. He started making pictures the year after Griffith.
Really?
And so that's what made me get really fascinated, because hearing him talk about those early days.
He made some wonderful pictures, those Fairbanks glass. Some of them are marvelous.
Great, yeah.
And of course, they're. I think I was much more interested in movie actors than in movies or movie directing. You know, right up to the end, I used to go to movies when I was running a theater in New York, and I went to see actors.
Mm-hmm. You were actor oriented, and you didn't think of the director until.
I wasn't. I was director oriented in the theater, mm-hmm. But except for O'Flaherty, I never. Was conscious of the movie maker as being all that interesting. It was just the great kind of vehicle for star personalities. Mm-hmm. Since I wasn't taking it seriously, yeah. It was just something that went to for simple pleasure. And I wasn't exposed to any talk about the film directors or anything at any time. And I didn't like the people who were considered very fine in the late 30s much, you know.
Like
Mamoulian and all that, you know. And those kind of people bored me to death, and those kind of movies did. So I always stayed away from artistic movies, what were then called artistic movies, yeah. You know.
I'm sure they bore you today, too.
Oh, of course.
Like Antonio.
Yes, yeah. Of course. And I never have seen these pictures that are supposed to have influenced me so much, these German ones.
Yeah.
And honestly, never even seen a clip of any of those. I've only seen some stills of the Valkyrie and all that.
Yeah. In other words,
Nibelungen, is that?
Lang.
Lang is supposed to be a big influence in my life. Only seen his American pictures, some of them very good.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen the ones that, you know, from the great Ufer days.
Yeah. Well, people had thought that you were influenced by Murnau and so on, but
I just didn't see him.